Welcome to Future Riches Podcast. I'm Barbara Ginty. I'm your host. I'm also a certified financial planner. And today we have a very special episode. We, for the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, we are having my uncle Jack, come on to talk about his experience as a firefighter during the 9/11 attacks. So hi, Uncle Jack.
How you doing, Bob?
Good. How are you?
Doing great.
Maybe we could start out with giving a little background so the listeners can get to know you a little better. But you started out actually as a police officer and then switched to the fire department, right?
Correct. I went on the police department October 63, and I switched to the fire department on November 29th, 1969.
Okay. So 6 years as a police officer.
Yes.
Wasn't really your thing, though.
No, I told you, I did 6 years, never gave up a ticket.
You weren't a good cop.
Out of that pay warrant.
So then you became a firefighter. You had a long career, and then at a certain point, you went into the union, which is fast forward.
I was assigned to Engine 42 in the South Bronx. That's when the Bronx was burning, 70s.
The 70s in New York were really bad.
Yeah, especially in the South Bronx. We did like 9,000 runs that year, which was actually more runs than, I don't remember, but it was in the paper. And like the combined departments of like six or seven southwestern states.
Oh my gosh.
All of their departments.
And wasn't that when the time frame, and so you didn't, did you not use oxygen then? Wasn't it different?
Well, that came out. The scuba tanks, they're actually just air, they're not oxygen.
Oh, okay.
But the thing was, we were doing probably averaging somewhere near 25 runs a night. So if you used it, you'd lose them. I mean, you had four of them on, five of them. So when we'd go to fires, one guy would carry the mask. It was in a box. And if it was a situation that we had to make some real back room and there was no other way to make it, one guy would mask up to do it. Because what would happen is if you used them, they'd be gone by the first one and then you'd have no mask left. So we didn't use them.
So you didn't use them at all? Because isn't that standard now that you use them?
Yeah, they use them for, I don't, it's probably right, but I see them doing it at car fires. I mean, we go to buildings where a lot of them are abandoned buildings, most of them are, and there'd be two or three floors on fire. But you learn how to live in a fire situation. I worry about young firemen that they've done nothing but the mask, nothing. So if you get into a situation in a fire where you can't see, but you see on television, the movie isn't what it's like. It's just pitch black and extremely hot. I mean, you're laying flat in your stomach crawling in. If you were to stand up, you'd be dead. I mean, that's how hot it got.
Oh, my gosh.
So, the thing is, if one of these young guys got trapped, and that happened a lot, and the mask ran out, there were different ways in that we learned. I mean, almost so that you could open a refrigerator. Yeah, it would be okay there. You could actually suck air out of couches and cushions and stuff.
Really?
But, it didn't happen. But the thing was, these guys were the best in the world at what they did. I mean, there was no equal. Not just mine, all of the firehouses there. So if you got trapped, if you get there and they say there's, somebody trapped in the back or a child or something, you, as we say, you get low and you go. You just tear in there. A lot of times there were cases where you couldn't get back. So you would have to depend on the guys with you and say, oh, we're going to put this out. But it worked. But you learned how to live in very, very precarious situations.
Well, yeah, I would think 9,000 fires in 1 year would give you...
Yeah, it was around there. Might be a little less, a little more, but it was around that amount.
And so that's when that's how you started your career. So you switched from the cops and went through the burning of the Bronx, which is for a lot of our listeners who probably never heard of it, the city was really bad in the 70s. And as you said, the Bronx was basically on fire the entire time.
They actually made a television show that they had me wired up, I think was called, it originally was going to be called The Bronx is Burning. This is when I first made a lieutenant. Bill Moyers made it. Newsman, and they changed it to the fire next door.
Oh.
Because Bronx is Burning, I guess, was a little too flashy. So that's how it went.
And then fast forward. So you were a firefighter for how many years before you went? You went into the union, and that, and then that will take us into 9/11.
I went in the union in 1988 or 89, but I still did my night tours. The way the chart was, you did 2 day tours, and you were off, and then you did 2 night tours.
Okay.
But the night tours were 15 hours a piece. The day tours were fine. So when I went in, I had excusal for the 2 day tours because I'd be at the union office. And then at night, I would go to firehouses, which I was glad. I actually liked going there. But eventually, I got elected to be the vice president. And then I had full excusal. So I was only doing the union job.
And when did that start?
Somewhere in like 93, somewhere in there. You know, I don't remember the exact years, but 93.
And the purpose of the union was to protect the firemen, right? To fight for
Their safety.
Their safety. And
you would do negotiate, you know, contracts. You would negotiate contracts for the medical coverages and things like that.
Okay. And so where were you the morning of 9/11?
I was in the office. What happened? That was a primary day.
Okay.
Primaries. It was a Tuesday. So I stayed over that night. I slept on a couch in the office because I had to coordinate all the political action that we were doing for all the candidates in all the five boroughs. So what happened was I'd get up around 6:30 in the morning to take a shower because then the office that people would come in.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the girls came in and said to me, a plane just hit the World Trade Center. We're one block away. We're on Broadway. That's on Church Street, right around the corner.
Okay.
So I assumed at that time it's going to be like a small plane, the Pike Covers. So.
Right, because for people who aren't listening, that had happened before where a small plane had hit a building, like a personal plane.
Yeah, that happened to somewhere else. A plane that actually hit the Empire State Building, a bomber. I guess it was during World War II, but that didn't knock down the building.
Yeah.
Without going to do is get, that was a different construction. That's called skeletal construction. So if you look at buildings being built and see the iron going up, it looks like square boxes.
Mm-hmm.
How buildings were built. The World Trade Center was built in a way that didn't come to New York City code. They called it core construction, where the core of the building, think of a square, that would be where the elevators are.
Mm-hmm.
Outside walls. And that would be the barren, the barren walls. So that they built that, they did a floor a day when they built it. So how they built it was, or they would just prefab everything on the ground and just put it in. So there were no structures. So when that plane went through, there was nothing to prevent it from going completely through until it hit the core.
And how did you know about the construction? Is that something that all firemen knew, how buildings are built?
Yeah, when you study it, you know, that's one of the major parts of study is called building construction. Because that by learning it, you learn how fire progresses up through, I don't even know what you would call them, but the pipe recesses.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever been in an apartment where a closet is in the corner, you know, corner, that's a recess because if you take the ceilings out of them, it'll go right to the roof. And I mean, to give you an example, if you had a fire in the basement, the first engine truck would go in there. The roof man, the next would go to the top floor because it's in the basement. The fire would break out on the top floor because all the heat will go up through those recesses, hit what they call the cockloft. That's the space between the ceiling and the top floor.
Okay.
And get in there and expands horizontally. So.
Okay.
So it's very knowledgeable. You don't study it in the fire academy. When you go, and when you're new, you're called a probie, and you're with the officer. And every fire we went to, after it was over, we would talk about how did it go up, was this, how could we have done this better.
Okay. You did like a reconnaissance, like went over everything.
Yeah. You go over.
So the morning of 9/11, you're in the union office, which is right around the corner from the World Trade Center.
Right.
And someone says to you,
one of the girls said to me, a plane. So I said, oh, I better get around there. And I come out and I make turn the corner and there's 1,000 people rushing up like a mob, mm-hmm. whole street full of people. And I look up and I can see where the plane went into the world, to the tower. And it went out on a slant at a 45 degree angle. And you could tell then it was a huge airline. You've seen that. And I remember to this day, every time I see a day that's completely cloudless, I always think it's like the World Trade Center. There wasn't a cloud.
It was a beautiful morning, right?
It was a beautiful morning. And I remember thinking, gee, this guy could have put that plane down in the harbor if he just, you know, inched it over a couple of feet. So at that point, I thought it was an accident, mm-hmm. the plane going down. And as I'm walking down the street, I look over on the left. There's a church. It's been in all the
movies,
programs and stuff. Yeah. And there's a cemetery there, a graveyard. And I see the coating from one of the engines. That's the metal cover that goes over the engines.
Yeah.
As I get to the corner, there's two FBI guys there. They have FBI jackets on. And I just mentioned to them, I said, you know, the coating for that engine is in the graveyard. And they bugged me. And a guy in a suit who must have been there, was an old man, came over and said, what? He told him, get over there and mark it. So now I'm standing on the corner looking at it. I'm going through the plaza that's out in front.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the second plane hit. And that came from the south. So I'm on the north side of that.
Yep.
Of that. So I didn't see the plane. I just saw it. So, like, every amount of certain amount of floors are called HEVs. That's where they had the air conditioning.
Yep.
And I thought maybe someone put, you know, explosives and blew it up. That's how it looked. But people were coming back, you know, on fire and stuff like that. That's when I realized, well, we got something else going on. It is, and basically, people were trapped. Not trapped. They were behind the glass doors. They were doors that turned.
Turnstiles, yeah.
Turnstiles, yeah. And if you didn't get them open, they were going to press against it. So there were other fire. We got that open. We got people.
So, and this was on which building you went to help get the doors open?
That would have been, at that time, it would have been the Northern Tower.
Okay.
Yeah. And I get through and people are going out.
Are you in? Because with a union, you're not in uniform. Did you just have a fire department?
Well, I had a jacket.
Got it.
Which we had said fire, New York City fire officer.
Okay.
Or else they wouldn't let you in the building.
Right.
I go through the building and I see most still people, but they're coming out in an orderly fashion and with people directing them. Beneath the entrance level is a mall,
mm-hmm.
which stores. I'm sure you've been there.
Yeah.
So I feel, let me get down there. And then there's trains coming in from Jersey.
Yep.
And I'm feeling, this is like around 9 o'clock, 9:30, somewhere near 9:30. There's people coming in. If they've been on trains, they have no idea.
Right.
So as I get down into the mall, I run into a chief, a guy, Dennis Devlin. Dennis had been a fireman for me in the Bronx. So I see him, and we just like looking. I don't remember the past time in my life. Was the bed or something like that. And he has a bunch of fire with him. I said, look, I'm going to head over to the lobby and see if I can get up there. I know all you could hear were fire trucks coming.
Right.
He goes, you know what? Let me take another quick walk around. Oh, no, we get down there to the trains. And there's a train in, and it isn't open. And there's nobody on the platform. So there's, I guess they got to conduct it. He said, oh, no, take the train back. We went back to Hoboken. And then we come up. And that's when I said, I'm going to go over. He said, I'm going to take a sweet mission. Never saw Dennis again. To this day, we haven't found Dennis. All those guys. The reason I tell you, I had just pure luck that day that everybody that was with me got killed, except me. And it was nothing to do, which I think, you know, I was in Ireland, New Zealand, explaining all this stuff is just pure luck. You know, people would say to me, well, you had all, like, it had nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
It was just luck.
You made a right and he made a left.
It, just like if I had said, all right, I'll take a walk with you or I'll help you.
Yep.
I wouldn't have done that. If he had come with me, he would have been alive at least before then. But that's just how it broke. No, nobody did anything wrong or I did something right, just right. The way it worked.
So you're underground then when you said to Dennis, he said he's going to take these firemen and go this way, and you said, I'm going to do another sweep that way.
I'm going to go over to where the building, the high-rise building.
Yep.
But we're under the building. You got to go through a big, long lobby to get over to the actual building, as we recall.
Yep.
And so I go through there, I get find some people, I got out. One of the doors exploded off the elevator because I guess the gasoline must have, because the plane must have been down, and then whatever, United blew one of the doors off. I get a whole bunch of people there. They're looking to go.
Yeah, where were you? Where were you sending people? Because you didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah, no, I knew how to get them out of the building.
Okay.
You know, these people are coming down, and it's something that anybody can get anything useful out of what I say today. People will always leave a building same way they came in. They will always.
That's just psychology, right? Like you always go back to the way, because you have always taught me, because I went and worked in New York City after, was you always taught me to identify the exits when you first get onto a floor.
That's exactly right. Because we did things later, and that was one of the, go into a floor, one was, I think, sitting back, had them say, okay, everybody go out, everybody went to the door. Mm-hmm. People were leaving to go to a door that's a floor away when there was an exit. So they went just to get people out, no big deal, they went out. And now I come out of the building, and now there's hundreds of firemen, trucks all over the place, and Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Fien was there, Pete Gansey, who was Chief of Department, and a guy, Timmy Stackpole. And Timmy had gotten hurt in Brooklyn, a building collapse. Well, he was in a that burnt really bad. So he was working his way back as an aide to, I think, to Billy Fien, to Chief Fien, Commissioner Fien. So as I come out, I come over, I see Pete Gansey, and Pete says to me, Pete and I will find him, we got the rocks. He said, hey, Jack, I need to stay here. We've got to get this under control. Because guys are just showing up and going in.
Yeah.
And if you don't have some sort of supervision or setup, so you know where people are, if you had to go get them. So meanwhile, we're fine, and they all want to get in. They want to go to work. And we're just saying, look, just back down here and get everybody, you're all going to get in, you know. And there's, I think it's called the World Financial Building, the one with the glass top.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a garage there. So they're backing into the garage. We get them there. There's one way out. When I say control, Pete would be controlling. As I get there, we have a board set up outside. I go turn, and there's a girl from the FBI. I don't know what she looked like. I know she had a red ponytail. And I look up, and the building's coming down. And it looked like what you'd see, like a mushroom cloud. And it's just sliding along, like someone sliding.
Did it feel like it was slow motion when you looked up?
Oh, yeah. I don't know if it was slow motion. But you just react. And I see it, and she's like looking straight up. So I go and I grab around, shoulder, waist, whatever, and we get into the garage. And now I can hear stuff, you know, debris here. I realize we got to get down and we're going to kill here. And there was an SUV parked against the wall. And when you learn about collapse, the strongest part is the bearing wall.
Right? Okay. It's,
so I figure, well, if we dive in here between this SUV and the wall, and then the thing hits, you know, and you hear it hit.
What did it sound like?
People ask that all the time. It just like being in the middle of an explosion, like people said, like a freight train. It was just unbelievably loud and vibrant.
I feel like in movies they say after that you can't hear, you just hear ringing because it's so loud.
No, it wasn't that. But I remember, like, if I saw this girl, I couldn't tell you what she looked like. I never saw her face. She was down. I got down, you know, pushed down, got thing, and then I just waited. Now the garage went down. I got down to the bottom of the garage, and there's people there. And I'm in like a lobby, and there's doors all over, like four doors, I don't remember. And we're trying to figure out which one goes to the financial center because we can't get out the way we came in. So anyway, they find a way. I open the door, and I see a rope tied to a doorknob. That's how you search large areas. We call it a search rope. With the same rope, you go off a roof with.
Okay.
But you stretch it so you have a way to find your way back.
Okay.
Because at this point, it's pitch black. I mean, you can't see your hand, but and it's full of, I guess, not smoke, but ash, you know, ash, cloud. Yeah. So, and there's kid Jimmy McGowan, he's fine. So I said, you know, I think we have people in here. So I said, I'll go along the rope and we'll see what's there. And he wants to know. I said, Jimmy, you got to stay by the door in case I can't find my way back. So I go along this rope. I'm yelling, anybody here, anybody here, nobody here. Oh, I see two firemen when I first went. So I said, you know, just put your hand out and take you back. And they would have found it themselves. So I get near the end, I'm yelling, nobody. Now I think I hear something. And I yell at it, now I hear somebody yell. So now I have to leave the rope to go find this person. And you try to go in direct straight lines because you can redo that coming back, yep. You know, rather than on tangents. Long story short, I crawl into like a hallway and somebody grabs a huge guy. And he's screaming at the top of his lungs, we're going to die. We're going to die and all that. And what you learn is don't say anything. Because after a while, they go, do you have anything you want to say? So I just said to him, basically, look, you know, if you shut up and get you out of here, but if you're going to panic, you're not coming out. But the reason I even bring that, I go along the road, find the road, get out, go to the door, and out the head. He was a black guy, huge. I think he had a badge. I think it might have been in his office. But I'd say he was 6'4", 300 pounds, big guy. And he's got me by the arm. So we go, I find a door, we go, we're a financial center. And this is what I think I told you one time. I start to go across and some of the glass lets go. But it was 70 feet from me, so that's when I realized you better start paying attention here. And anyway, I get this guy out. There's a big plaza back there, building, and he's bleeding. Nothing abandoned would handle. But he won't look at me and say, no, just get me in. But the reason I tell you, like Gansey and Fee and Stackpole that I was with, because I got delayed, I'm now behind them.
Right.
When you come out, the Hudson River is behind me, and the West Side Highway, where the buildings are I don't know how far it's a city block. They're long city block.
Yeah.
So I see them, and they make a right-hand turn. At this time, I don't know how much came down. I don't know if just the top of the building came.
Right.
So
you're taking this man to an ambulance, or you're trying to get
he's in an ambulance, but that delayed me because of. So when I get up to the corner, now the other tower, the north tower, that first one hit was the last one to come down. So Finn and Gansey and a couple of them have already gone. Then I see the rubble, I realize, you know, that building's down. As I start to go into the second building, the one that's standing, a guy, Tommy Fitzpatrick, again, I worked with him in the Bronx, so he was an aide to the commission. He's yelling something from in front of the building. He's directly under it.
And they had a command station, is that correct? So they were all set up?
Well, that was crushed under the first
one. Okay.
So he was, I don't know what he was going to say. So I start trotting over to him to see what the plan is. As I get to him, now that building comes out. I'm directly under this one. So, and again, I made a mistake. I start to run. I should have run back exactly how I came because there was buildings there. I had started to run up the West Side Drive. And as soon as I did, I just made a major mistake. But I knew I could not run it, so I dove onto a fire truck. And then the whole thing came down, and I was buried in there.
You were buried in there. That's where. So the first tower, you were buried in the garage with the redheaded FBI agent who you don't know who she is.
Yes.
And then from there, you got a gentleman out of the rubble into an ambulance, which delayed you, and you got...
Right, or else, when they went up and made that turn to go to where they went, when the second building came down, there was nowhere for them to go.
Right, so...
And I know he actually got decapitated under that stuff. It was pretty bad where they were.
So, and luckily, you took this gentleman that you found in the garage.
I would have been right next to him.
Right.
So, no one has made mistakes except me that I know of, the one in the world. financial walking under the glass. I don't know what I was thinking. And in this thing,
So you got down to the first building, which was the second to collapse, late because of helping a man get into an ambulance.
Correct. If I hadn't run into him, I would have been with Pete.
And what I think is really interesting is you've never met these people since.
You mean which people?
The FBI agent or the guy from the ambulance. Like, you've never seen them since.
No, there was no reason to.
It's just interesting that you went through this experience together and then never found each other after. But anyway, so now we get to your heading back to see your colleague at the base, basically, of second building to come down. And that starts to come down, and you take off running up the West Side Highway.
Mm-hmm.
And then it comes down.
I realize I'm not going to get that far. You know, I don't know how far I got. And I see the rig. I figure I'll die on the head. It's the only chance out, you know. And I'm under a rig. And you've seen pictures of how these rigs were crushed.
Mm-hmm.
There were tires, a double tires on both sides.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know, weeks later, I went back. The only tires that weren't blown were the ones I was between. The front was all crushed.
So you went under the back of the rig, the back of the fire truck.
Yeah. So, and his rigs parked one next, you know, behind the other. And I remember I remember hearing the sound of that. It's like somebody dropping box stars on it. And the ground is shaking. And I don't know if it's the ground or the rig is shaking, but it stops. And I remember thinking, am I alive? Because again, when you saw the cloud, I'm in that now.
Right.
This rig. I never touched my finger to my eyes saying, okay. And now saying to myself, all right, start paying attention here, you know. So now, I don't know how long a period of time, I remember thinking there had been a story about a collapse in Mexico City, an earthquake, where they found the baby 13 days later. So I said, well, I remember that. I said, well, you might have to be in here a while. But I figured out.
Were you by yourself?
Yes, I'm by myself then. They could have actually, I was by myself. But you could have been right next to me. I wouldn't have been able to see you. I couldn't actually see my hand if I touched my nose. That's because it's completely black because of that cloud taking in. So I remember thinking, man, it's getting a little hot here. So I crawl out under the rig. I get behind through an opening, and now I'm behind under another rig.
Okay.
As I'm crawling, I bump into a guy, and I hear his mask. He's breathing. The Scott mask is called. So I say, "You okay?" He's right.
But you can't see each other.
No, can't see. I can touch him, and he's like, you know, and he has the mask on. So I had said to him, you know, it might be a good idea to take that off because you might need it if it gets really bad. You know, what I was doing, and he was doing, you put the shirt or anything over and try to breathe through the shirt to keep the dust. But anyway, we're there. And again, I don't remember exactly how this went, but he wanted to go. And I said, no, let's just wait a little while because when glass collapses and the glass pops out, that stay up there for a long period of time. You know, it's like if you flip it, you know, it's like frisbees.
And
I said,
and is that that's dangerous to breathe in glass?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, I was worried about if we crawled out, this glass came down on
us. Got it. Okay.
So we were in there a bunch, and then we talked. And now it's starting to get heat blasts, like someone opened the door of an oven, and we got to go. Now the thing is,
how long do you think you were under the fire trucks for?
Around 40 minutes, maybe. Okay. You know, some people said it a little longer, but a period of time like that.
Okay.
But I remember thinking, all right, we got to make sure we're going north because south is into the towers.
Yeah, and it was just you and one other person then, just this one fireman.
Yeah, and I see him. He's a captain today. I've seen him. He's a redhead guy. He's a second redhead guy.
Another redhead, okay.
So, anyway, I said, you know, as long as we keep our hand on the barrier of the wall, our right hand, then we have to be going north because you can get turned around because some of those rubble. And then, anyway, we get out of it.
How long did you have to dig out? Because wasn't there rubble?
Lots of it had to move stuff, but it wasn't like you're a lot of digging, you know.
Okay.
When somebody claims you could see light in certain areas, so you went towards that. But the thing, we get out, we go up, and to this day, I don't remember this at all. I'm in the office, I don't know, a week later. Our office, we didn't go. We were up on Park Avenue using the lawyer's offices. And I got a call from Warren Mill, and he says, I'm calling to thank you, you got me. And I said, no, it wasn't me. He said, yeah, it was you. I said, certainly what? I'm telling you, it wasn't me. Debris had backed up, and he was behind the debris in the entrance to a building.
Mm-hmm.
Went by, he was digging out and had blood. He said, do you remember telling me to get in the ambulance? I said, I remember saying to somebody, everybody wanted to go right back. I remember saying to him, well, just go in and get clear, you know, and come back. I remember that, but I don't remember ever getting up at all. To this day, I don't remember. And then, like I said, the rest of the day, we just went back, you know,
so you,
hopefully find somebody.
Yeah, so you and this other fireman dug your way out of being under the fire trucks, headed north.
Yeah.
And then once you had a bearing on everything, you went back down to see if you could dig people out of the rubble?
Everybody did. Okay. We're all in a certain area. And I'll tell you, fire department's amazing. They immediately, our chief department's gone, commission's gone, Bill Fee, and Danny Nigro, who's the commissioner, he was there. He was a chief at that time. It just, everybody got together. And I remember saying to Danny Nigro, damn it, sure in charge here. So we just all started going back, going on the pot. We called the pile just to try to see if we could get anybody. Around 4 o'clock, those guys came out, Chief Pricciata. They were the ones saved that black woman that was in a wheelchair. They carried it down on those flights. So they were the only ones to come out.
Come out of the buildings, right?
Because no one ever came out again. I just remember the horror. You looked at the body parts, bodies all over the place.
I was going to ask you, what was the worst part of it?
You know what it was? No one ever get. When I first got there, I was watching the people jump. Because at any fire I had ever been at, we had people trapped, and we got 90-some-odd% of them. At least you could do something. You could say, you could do something. You could try to get up to the fire floor, whatever. I remember thinking, there's nothing you can do. And I'll tell you, that's something that's never published. I would say 80% of them were women. Because who comes in the office early? Not the executives, the secretaries. So this was playing it right before 9 o'clock. And I remember a whole group coming out holding hands, you know, and they were all women. You would hear things like, it sounded like thump, and that was a body hit. You hear something, oh man, it's more. But I remember looking up, and they came out, and they were holding hands. And I remember, it's like one woman I saw, she was pretty close coming down. I think I could have, if someone showed me a picture, I might have been able to recognize it. But I remember she had a gypsy skirt, if that's what you call it, you know, with a wide band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I remember the flowing. She got cut in half. She got hit one of the batteries. So it was hard, you know, what was going on. You know, you don't expect to see that.
No, and I feel like that's something that people talk about, people being trapped in the building, but I don't think you hear a lot of people talking about, because it's gory and gruesome and hard to hear, but that there were so many people jumping out of the building.
They had no choice. You know, that when I was speaking, I spoke in Ireland. That was a bit at a soccer game. And on the TV station, I did Good Morning America there, Good Morning Ireland, I guess. And they would say, well, why would they jump? Yeah. I said, because you don't have a choice. I mean, if I told you, stand on this lawn, and if you don't move, I'll give you $1 million. And I put a cigarette on your back. You're moving. You just can't stand. Even five of that jump on Black Sunday, the five guys that jump. You don't have a choice. It's not a choice.
Do you think that was the worst part of it, was seeing that?
It was. It probably wasn't the worst part, so many people dying. But I just remember that was the first time that I was ever in a position, even on the tops, I could do nothing.
Right.
I could stand, watch it. I couldn't
do anything about it.
Yeah.
What would be, this is a question from one of our listeners. What would be one thing you wish you could go back and tell yourself about that day?
Really, there's not much I could tell. You know, it happened to us.
Right.
It wasn't a result of some action I had taken saying, you know, gee, I should have gone a different way to work today. In some ways, I was glad that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least I tried to do something. You know, we tried.
Right.
But, you know, it's just, unless you were there, it's something that it's hard to explain. There was a smell to it. And that afternoon, it got really hot, too. I remember how hot it was. And then, you know, that was, like I say, 11. We were there. Like, I stayed there till Sunday. So did everybody else. I don't want to keep saying I. You know, we slept on floors and buildings because we kept digging, trying to find. I remember that happened Tuesday. I went home Sunday. But everybody else did. So, you know, we were just trying, guys, and what do you hear? And I was there for all the lies that Whitman, when she was there and said, oh, you can breathe this air. You know, I mean, we even knew. I mean, I remember a whole group of us standing around and just, without saying this, saying, you know, who's, you know, we do this all the time. Don't tell me you can breathe this, you know.
Well, yeah, because the air.
As a result, my lungs are shot. You know, that's what I was saying. I kept trying to stay. I didn't want to leave. But when they finally caught up to me, I mean, just for my injuries, I was given disability for the cervical spine, lumbar spine, left hip, and my lungs. So.
Well, because you, how old were you when 9/11?
Yeah.
You were almost at retirement,
yeah. Right? I was what?
Weren't you almost to retirement?
Yeah. Oh, I could have retired 20 years. I had to get out when I got out. I was probably in my late 50s.
Mm-hmm. And then they have mandatory retirement, right, at 65? Or
yeah, 65. Yeah. I did actually the most time of anybody. I came on at 21 and out just around 66. So if you count police time.
Yeah, if you count the police time. Yeah, 40 years.
Somebody even asked me that on television. I think in New Zealand. And they said, you know, why did you do so much time? I said, because I'm a bit of a moron and I don't have any other skills, which I don't.
So since we're, I mean, I think the story is incredible, like to hear firsthand what it was like.
No, it's
to be
more incredible than everybody else's. I mean,
no, but just all the stories that have come out of there for the people that were there. And since I can't believe we're coming up on the 20th. Reunion. And what's interesting, and you've talked to my boyfriend's nephew, but he was so interested to have talked to somebody who lived through it because he's learning about it in a history book. He has, right? There's a whole generation of children who didn't live through this, where they're just reading about it in a book.
Yeah. And that, you know, I just hope they keep the memory of it alive. I mean, we lost 343 firemen in that day. It's just fine.
Yeah.
And I knew most of them, and some of them very, very well.
What is the number one? So I think the best way we can probably serve for everyone's memory is to keep the memory alive, right? So that people know what happened. Yeah. And then
say September 11th, like, you know, say a prayer for them and their families. That was the other hard part with the union. Now, I had to go visit the families, you know, without going, we give them a check for $10,000 right away so they can do it. And I remember it was a lieutenant from the squad in Brooklyn went, and I was talking to the wife, and a little boy came up and said to me, oh, my daddy's a fireman. And I was there. That hurt. We had 93 officers killed that day. So we broke it up among guys. So I had 11 of them. I did them all in one day. I started at 7 in the morning, go to set, and I was going to leave, and I just didn't. I knew if I left, I didn't want to come back and do it, so I just did it till about 11 o'clock that night, just because I didn't want to do this again.
Right.
It was just horrible.
And that was you going to visit the families of those lost.
Yes, to let them know this is what the pensions would be, this is what we'll do if you have any problems. We had camp, just whatever the program was.
Right.
But the women were unbelievable. Unbelievable. How they handled it. They were remarkable. Yeah. you know, they had family, that well, they had family, that I had, they had all families.
Families.
One had a mother and a wife. I remember the saying, well, he died how he, if he had to die, that's how he'd like to have done it. All right. And some of them would say to me, are you okay? And I go, oh, yeah, I'm okay. So.
What's the number one question you get about 9/11?
Obviously, they say, people say that, well, they had information on these guys, or they should have had information on these guys. You go to take airplane lessons or flying lessons, and you say, I don't know how to land. I don't need that. That should tell you something.
Right.
Do you resent it? And I don't resent it. You know, I don't think anybody particularly didn't do their job. Sometimes one person hears something, someone hears something else. These are, you know, fate. It's just meant to be. But, you know, the great thing that came out of it was how close the country was.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. You know, I remember it was late at night, I guess, on that night, about 10 or 11 o'clock, and nobody had eaten. Everything was nowhere to go.
Right.
And there was a black woman that had a box with McDonald's in it. And a guy, Rick Arizosa, and he and I worked in 42 Engine together. And he said, yeah, just come out. And I said, you don't have any money, because you don't carry money when you're working.
When you're working a fire, yeah.
And I thought, you know, he's probably one of the poorest people in the city. She's the first one down here with food. But you saw, after a lot of celebrities, I remember Liz Taylor ran into her the Friday after that at night. She was walking around lost. But it just, like, you couldn't spend anything. To go and eat, you had to go up around 14th Street, Addison Street, somewhere up there, where they wouldn't let you below. People wouldn't take your money. Even the rest wouldn't take your money. You know, people, anything you need.
So that was probably how
close the country came.
Right.
And now it's without political. I don't know who's right, who's wrong. I don't care. But the way it's so divided today, if learned anything from what happened, it was how close the country was. You weren't Republican, you weren't Democrat, you weren't white, black, green, everybody pulled together.
Right.
And 20 years later, it's all not torn apart, but it could be better.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think that I do agree that was probably a silver lining in a horrible, tragic event, was that the country really did come together.
Well, one of the questions I was asked, you know, more recently was, do I have nightmares or anything like that? And I don't at all. Yeah. I mean, there are days where I'll just sit and think about it. I remember one time saying, did I really go? Was I really there? You know, I knew I was, but I remember, were you really there? And, you know.
Do you watch any of the documentaries? I think with the 20th anniversary, there's a bunch more that came out. But did you go visit the memorial? Did you watch the documentaries? Or is it
I've
something?
Never been. People ask me that all the time. And we left in May, and as we called it, broom clean. You know, that's nobody left in what we call then the pit. Mm-hmm. And out, and from that day, I've never been back.
And you will never go back?
I think I will, but if I do, I go by myself.
Okay.
You know, I'm, you know, to see those names, you know, like I say, I worked with those guys, played golf, yeah, you know, everything. We did everything together. And they're not here anymore.
Right. Hmm. Do you watch the documentaries or the movies about it? There's two big ones now.
I've seen one or two, you know, I've seen the one about the fire, and they came back to the firehouse that day. That was a French crew. You know what it was? There were people, because I was at the union, I knew a lot of the news people, mm-hmm. because I did that. And they wanted to interview, and I didn't know. I remember Dan Radley. We were going back in the afternoon, and he was, I think it was him, and someone said that it was the Iranians. Which was easiest. Someone said, yeah, it was the Iranians. Do you think we should retaliate? Should we hit them with the missiles? One of the news people said. I said, you're going to hit some poor guy walking behind a donkey in Iran. He had nothing to do with this, you know? So, and then it was good. The cops moved the, because they were, when we went back, news people were all over the place.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, trying
to get the story. You know, you're trying to do something and they got a camera coming over your shoulder. But I'm just, I'm glad I was there. Because I don't know if I would have felt that I should have been there and I wasn't. And, you know, you get all these crazy things, but,
yeah,
you know, I think about it. People ask me things like, were there, do you think you could have done something? There's nothing that would happen to you, you know?
Right. Well, Uncle Jack, I appreciate you sharing your story with us for...
And I don't, and you know that, I don't go around telling anybody about it at all, but... Somebody said to you one time, well, if people don't tell a story, will people forget? And I'm sure there's people who are a lot better at this than I am, you know?
Yeah, but yours is a real story. You were there. And I think as you said, it's important to remember what happened that day and that we keep the memory alive so that people don't forget. And so I think this is a great way to honor the 20th anniversary.
You know who should be honored of all people? Remember Rusty Staub, the baseball player?
Not that good
of
sports.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Rusty Staub had started the Police and Fire Widows Foundation.
Oh, okay.
And I was on that because the original fireman that was on the diet, so I had Patty Burns from that. And he went all over the country on his own money, raised millions and millions of dollars, and would wouldn't let you tell anybody. He only passed away about 2 years ago, a year ago. But he, over the years, he raised hundreds of million dollars to pay for all these kids' college. And it's called the Police Fire Widow Fund. And it's all big people from Wall Street. I think I told you that.
Mm-hmm.
He's American. And we wanted to call it the right, and he wouldn't let us put his name on it.
He
absolutely did. Nobody did more than Rusty Staub.
But a lot of people didn't advertise what they did.
So. Yeah, a lot. But no one did more than he did. Nobody.
Well, Uncle Jack, thanks for coming on and sharing your story.
Yeah. Hope I didn't bore you.
No, I'm sure you didn't. And for all of our lovely listeners, you can find our most up-to-date information on Instagram at the Future Rich Podcast. And thank you for listening in to this 20th anniversary of 9/11 special segment.